The reading is taken from Luke chapter 5, verse 33 to chapter 6, verse 11. This can be found on page 1033 of the Church Bibles. Luke chapter 5, beginning to read at verse 33. Jesus questioned about fasting. They said to him, "John's disciples often fast and pray, and so do the disciples of the Pharisees, but yours go on eating and drinking." Jesus answered, "Can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days they will fast." He told them this parable. No one tears a piece out of a new garment to patch an old one. Otherwise, they will have torn the new garment, and the patch from the new will not match the old. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins. The wine will run out, and the wineskins will be ruined. No, new wine must be poured into new wineskins, and no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for they say, "The old is better." Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the cornfields, and his disciples began to pick some ears of corn, rub them in their hands, and eat the grain. Some of the Pharisees asked, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Jesus answered them, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and taking the consecrated bread, he ate what is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions." Then Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." On another Sabbath, he went into the synagogue and was teaching, and a man was there whose right hand was shriveled. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. But Jesus knew what they were thinking and said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Get up and stand in front of everyone." So he got up and stood there. Then Jesus said to them, "I ask you, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to destroy it?" He looked round at them all, and they said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He did so, and his hand was completely restored. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. This is the word of the Lord.
Thank you. Well, good morning. Okay, so who looked at the title of this morning's sermon and thought this might be a good one to give a miss? I bet there were a lot of people over the road volunteering. Anybody need any extra help in any of the children's groups? We're studying rules and regulations this morning. It doesn't sound enormous fun. By the end of the next 25 minutes, you will have a completely different opinion, possibly. Why don't we start by looking at some ridiculous ancient laws which still stand in this country, because that sounds quite fun to me. Some absolutely true British laws that are still on the statute books, and you technically could be prosecuted for. So first of all, according to the Treason Felony Act of 1848, it is still an act of treason to place a postage stamp bearing the monarch's head upside down on an envelope. According to the Public Health Control Act of 1984, you're not allowed to travel in a black cab if you have the bubonic plague. The Metropolitan Police Act of 1839 forbids anyone still from carrying a plank of wood along a pavement or erecting a washing line across any street. The Licensing Act of 1872 is very clear in its wording. You cannot operate a cow while intoxicated. I don't know what it means to operate a cow, but you mustn't do it if you've had a drink. You cannot, according to a very specific clause in a 2004 Farming Act, import potatoes into England or Wales if you have reasonable suspicion that they might be Polish. I'm going to make no comment at that point, but there's some satire to be had if you want it. Any whale or sturgeon caught off the coast of the UK is the property of the Queen, thanks to the King's prerogative of 1322. This might be the best one. According to the Licensing Act, 1872, it is illegal to be drunk in a pub. That may be broken a few times a day. And finally, this is probably the most important thing to take away from this morning, an important thing to teach your children, the Salmon Act in 1986. There's a whole act for salmon. The Salmon Act, says, you are not allowed to handle a salmon in suspicious circumstances. So just a warning there. If you find any suspicious salmon, you could be breaking the law if you handle it. Now, it's likely there were good reasons behind each of those laws at the time that they were made. There was fear of the plague still in 1984. There was a chance that it could come back. There was obviously an issue with Polish potatoes. There was obviously something with suspicious salmon at some point. But now, they just happen to be on the statute books. Modern life has obviously dispensed with the need for them. And you'd have to be really, really strange and nerdy about the law to try and prosecute someone on one of those grounds in 2016. And in a similar way, but not the same, there are a whole bunch of rules in the Bible which have lost a lot of their relevance and pertinence to us too. And don't worry, I'm not going to go off into hugely liberal territory here. But we have to remember that when the original law was given to Moses in the time of Exodus, the book of Exodus, human beings had literally forgotten what it meant to be human. So the Israelites had been enslaved for 400 years, and their unimaginable daily existence involved every day, from morning until night, making bricks. They weren't treated as humans. They weren't allowed to live normal lives. They had no concept of what it meant to be human. And so when God gives them the law, it's not that he's big and bad and has this big list of rules and commandments that must be obeyed because I'm the Lord your God and you must do what I say because I'm bigger than you. It's that they have forgotten how to be human and he wants to rehumanize them. He's giving them boundaries that keep them safe, not rules. So for example, I'm going to enjoy this. There's this brilliant rule about always having a spade with you. Designate a place outside the camp where you can go to relieve yourself. As part of your equipment, have something to dig with, and when you relieve yourself, dig a hole and cover up your excrement. I was telling my kids this morning that I got to talk about poo in church, and they did not believe me, and I just have. Deuteronomy 23, it's there if you want to look it up. Now why is this in the Bible? Is it because God detests the unclean stuff? Well, no, not really. I don't think that's really what it's about. It's the fact that they didn't know how to live as a camp, and so they might have just not dealt in a sanitary way, in a hygienic way, with those things. And so had that not been in the Bible, had that not been given to them, then they were putting themselves, there was probably a massive health risk. There would have been horrible diseases spreading through the camp like wildfire. So actually, it's about teaching them to be human. And then some laws were given to help us develop the right kind of character. So Leviticus 20, I get to say testicles now as well. Leviticus 22, verse 24. You must not offer to the Lord an animal whose testicles are bruised, crushed, torn, or cut. Why is that? Is that because God demands perfection? Is that because God is angry and you must do everything right and you mustn't try and shortchange him? Well, not really. Because The reason why someone might have sacrificed one of these animals is because they were kind of spare. They were kind of damaged and couldn't reproduce, and so they were worth less. And so if someone gave a sacrifice to God, they weren't really giving a full sacrifice to God. They were kind of taking the easy way out. And so God gives this law, not because he's angry and he needs to give rules, but because he wants to develop a truly generous, truly sacrificial character, that where we give of our best, not sort of afterthought like this. And the point I want you to take away, and from that, and probably from all of this morning, is that the rules in the Bible were made for us, not us for the rules. So the Old Testament sets up a whole number of these rules, hundreds of them, but a vast number of them about weird things like mildew, which were saving lives at the time, but aren't relevant now. The thing about Old Testament rules is that they were all part of the way in which humanity stayed on the right side of God. And by living as they were made to be, by recognizing him as God through this sacrificial system, by paying for their mistakes through that, by following the rule book, Israel remained God's people. But then Jesus changes all of that. He brings a new way for people to know God directly through him. And in doing that, In opening up the way, in dying on the cross, he kind of tears up the rule book. Not the Old Testament, but he tears up the rule book. And not everybody likes that. In fact, there may be part of us that is uncomfortable with that right now. Well, that is a good cue to finally move on to this morning's passage. And as you know, we've been working our way through the Gospel of Luke, and Jesus has been foretold and born and tested in the wilderness, and he has been rejected in his hometown. He's begun doing miracles. He started calling some disciples. And now at this point, he starts to run into some more trouble, and he starts to develop some enemies. And they're people who have been raised to believe the opposite of this. They believe that we were made for rules, not the rules for us. In the passage we've just heard, it might be helpful to have it open in front of you. We get three episodes in Jesus' life and ministry where he encounters these people, the Pharisees. There are three related moments which may have happened close together, but more likely they happened at different times in Jesus' ministry, and Luke has drawn them together here to help us understand a wider point. So the first of these episodes here gives us the big context of this passage and of Jesus lining up against these Pharisees. And in the Gospels, Jesus repeatedly finds himself in conflicts with these people who he would actually rather get him off the scene. Even though they're religious people, they'd rather get rid of him than entertain the idea that he might be in the right. So who were the Pharisees? Well, along with the Sadducees, who we also hear about in the Gospels, the Pharisees comprised the sort of ruling class of Israel. So they were sort of middle-class businessmen. Not all of them were priests, but they had real power in the Sanhedrin, which was this sort of religious parliament that governed occupied Israel, because they were in touch with the common man. And that meant, even though there were fewer of them, they had this kind of controlling interest in Israeli parliament. So they were powerful men. They were religiously observant of what we now call the Old Testament. And most of their beliefs were orthodox. They believed in resurrection. They believed in an afterlife. They believed in God's sovereign control over the world. They believed in free will. They were in many ways the sort of perfect audience for Jesus to come to. And yet they don't get on at all, because the Pharisees are also these fiercely traditional people. They are men who do not want to see things change, because they've always been done this way, because the rule book says so. And that has worked well so far. They're not just resistant to change, they hate change because they love tradition. And that means they don't listen, they're not prepared to listen to the possibility that things might need to change and Jesus might actually be who he says he is. And Jesus is usually known for being kind and loving and mild and meek, right? But when he's delivering his harshest sentiments, they're usually aimed at the Pharisees. So he calls them, "You brood of vipers." He calls them, "You snakes." He calls them whitewashed tombs. He puts them as characters in some of his parables and some of the stories that he tells. And he makes them the butt of the joke. So he tells a story about two men who are talking to God, essentially, and one recognizes his utter wretchedness and sinfulness and just asks for mercy. And then the Pharisee stands there, and he says, "I thank you, God, that I am not like this guy. I thank you that I'm not like other men." And I imagine that not as some pious scene. Actually, I imagine Jesus telling that in a pub. I imagine people roaring with laughter because the sort of political class are getting made fun of in this way. So Jesus constantly finds himself in conflict with the Pharisees. They keep pushing Jesus' buttons and he keeps pushing theirs. And it's quite surprising because Jesus is quite into religion and so are they. So they should get on really well. But this episode helps us to understand why they don't. So this first section, I won't read it again, but this first section here is where they come to him and they basically try to catch him out. So rather than trying to understand Jesus, the first thing they do is they try to catch him out. So they say, "Our disciples fast, but we've noticed yours go on eating and drinking, so not that holy, really, not that good. What's going on there? Come on, Jesus, what gives here?" They don't like the fact that Jesus is not commanding his disciples to follow him in this strict religious way, and that they're reacting against people who are joyful, and they would prefer them to be much more pious. I wonder whether they find it unfair that these disciples are not having to endure a more religious life like they do. And then Jesus, in this first bit, Jesus provokes them quite gently, first of all, by starting to talk about himself as God. Now, for the Pharisees, there's pretty much nothing worse you can say than, "Oh yeah, I'm God." That is like the greatest blasphemy, that people are stoned for a lot less than that by the Pharisees. And yet Jesus, sort of playfully at this point, although it gets more serious quite soon after, talks about himself in those terms. He says, come on, can you make the friends of the bridegroom fast while he is with them? But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them. In those days they will fast. So he's hinting towards stuff they don't even understand yet. But there's enough there for these religious people. They're religiously literate enough. They're metaphorically literate enough to understand that Jesus is having them on here. Jesus is saying something quite controversial about himself. And then finally, just in this first section, we see that they're resistant to change. And he calls them out on that straight away. So we have these two metaphors, one about a new garment and an old garment. Why would you cut a piece out of a new shirt to fix an old one? Surely you just put on a new shirt, right? And this thing about wineskins, we don't have wineskins anymore, but they didn't have bottles then. So this thing about why would you pour a new wine into old wineskins? That would be, they would be ruined. But then there's this last line. So after he kind of hints, there's something more, there's something new. I'm bringing a new way that's different to yours. There's this last line that says, "And no one after drinking old wine wants the new, for they say the old is better." Now, first of all, let me say I don't understand wine at all. Are there any proper like wine enthusiasts in the room? No, it's okay. It's all right, I think. In the context of this, it's definitely all right. So I don't understand wine, but I think now older wine is better, right? I'm looking at you. So if wine is older, that's better, yeah? But I think the point of Jesus's line here is to say, look, if you're used to drinking old wine, if you're used to the old ways, you won't want to even try the new ways. You won't even want to try the new wine because you're just stuck in the old stuff. You're just stuck. The old is better. It's his way of saying, with the Pharisees again, the butt of the joke, that some people just can't seem to deal with change. So, Jesus and the Pharisees are totally cross purposes here. Jesus has come to liberate people from rules and religion, and the Pharisees reject any attempt from him to step outside the boundaries of what they expect of a rabbi. And before we move on, it's worth just asking ourselves, where are we in that story? We'd like to be with Jesus. We'd like to be on Jesus's side there, wouldn't we? But as we look at those things, being too legalistic, not believing Jesus truly is who he says he is, being resistant to change even when God himself might be calling to us. Do we see a bit of that in ourselves? I certainly see a bit of those things in myself. The second episode, let's move on to the second episode. So we've had the context of Jesus lining up against the Pharisees. The second little episode of the three gives us this big tension, which is on one side, the religion that the Pharisees offer against the knowing God personally, which is what Jesus comes to offer. So Luke gives us another round of Jesus versus the Pharisees now. And they've tried to catch him out on fasting, and now it's time to drag up some archaic laws about observing the Sabbath. So this time, he's kind of deliberately provoking them. So can I have the passage up, please? So this time, he's kind of deliberately provoking them now, because they are watching to see now whether he is going to make a mistake. And so on the Sabbath, he and his disciples start to, his disciples start to pick heads of grain, rub them in their hands, eat the kernels, which technically, you're not supposed to do, because that could be construed as work. Now, there's this really great explanation of that by the great Scottish theologian William Barclay, who says, four of the forbidden kinds of work on the Sabbath were reaping, threshing, winnowing, and preparing food. So those are the four things you're not allowed to do that constitute work on the Sabbath. And by plucking corn, they're guilty of reaping. By rubbing in their hands, technically of threshing. By flinging away the husks of winnowing. And the very fact they ate it showed they prepared food on the Sabbath. So to a strict Pharisee, rules and regulations had been broken, and this was a matter of life and death. So Jesus knows exactly what he's doing here. He knows exactly what he's doing. His disciples are breaking the old laws, but in the most sort of pathetic and minimal way possible. In fact, it is really petty to draw all those old references together and then call Jesus out on it. But there's even a verse Jesus could call up from Deuteronomy, which kind of answers that and gives special dispensation for why this was okay anyway. And he would have known that, but he doesn't, because he wants to make them think. So Jesus is now a little bit clearer about his identity when they ask, why are you doing this? He's a little bit clearer about that controversial blasphemy issue we just talked about. So he's now saying, he now compares himself essentially to David and his companions. Now that again, that's quite explosive. He's comparing himself to the greatest hero he possibly could, King David, and his companions. He's comparing himself to him, first of all. And then he goes even further, and he describes himself as Lord of the Sabbath. He's somehow able to overrule the religious rules they've always followed. So he's claiming to be God, and the Pharisees are bubbling with rage at this. And finally, Jesus is saying in this section, religion only takes you so far. It's worthless without a real connection to God, and that is what he offers. So when he's responding to these Pharisees, he's trying to clearly explain to them that he has something better than their religious way of looking at the world. His disciples need to eat, so do you know what? He's going to let them eat. Grace trumps the law. And instead of picking on a single verse, he quotes the bigger picture. He quotes this whole story from the Old Testament that reaches back into the Old Testament to essentially say a new version of what we've already said, that the Sabbath is made for man, not man for the Sabbath. That there's a point to this thing, and it's not what you think it is. That I am the Lord of rest, not of religious observance. I want you to take a break every week. I don't want you to massage my ego. That's what the Sabbath is about, not legalism, but grace. It's for you. That's why you should take a break one day a week. That's why you should have a break on a Sunday. It's not because God demands it, because he's angry and big and he likes telling you about his rules. We should all take a break, because otherwise we start to break down. We can't work 7 days a week. But at the same time, if you need to answer an email... This isn't Jesus. If you need to answer an email, then that's okay. That's okay, because the bigger point is still being observed. You're taking a break. So that's the key tension that's going on here, and it's where we started. The Pharisees say man was made for rules, And Jesus says, no, you've got it all wrong. The rules were just made for you. The Sabbath was just made for you. You can't see the wood for the trees. You're staring so hard at the detail, you can't see the bigger picture. And again, before we move on now to this last encounter, ask yourself again, where do you find yourself in that story? Are you with Jesus? Have you embraced the Lord of rest? Or are you quite easily provoked by religious issues around things like morality and around change? Have you got a little bit hung up on religion? Are you a little bit unclear about who Jesus really is? I worry sometimes I'm a little bit of a Pharisee. I think we all tend that way sometimes because it's easier to be black and white about things. But I think Jesus offers us an alternative to that. So finally, Luke gives us one more story of Jesus encountering the Pharisees, and this time he's escalating things much more. So in this first episode, he's the teacher having this theoretical conversation about religious observance. And in the second episode, he's making quite bold suggestions about who he might be. And his disciples are starting to physically encroach very slightly on the law. And then in the final episode, for any Spinal Tap fans, he turns the amp up to 11. Now, this time, they are watching him like hawks. It says there, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely. They don't trick him into doing something in this episode. They don't trick him into breaking their law. They just watch him. So he knows he's being watched, and he knows that if he does this, it's going to create a major sensation. It's going to create problems for him. And they're going to watch him to see if he's prepared to heal on the Sabbath, which their own rules strictly forbid. But of course, they don't actually expect him to actually manage it and so prove his own divinity. But that's exactly what he does. So he's gone from being a teacher talking about religion to this troublemaker bending the rules of religion to the Son of God standing right there in front of them, doing something extraordinary and glorious. And this is Jesus's offer to them and to us. Don't get caught up in religion. The rules are there for you, not for their own sake. And in fact, more than that, the game has changed. The rules are no longer the way you access God, because the bridegroom is here with the guests now. Chapter 5, verse 34. The rules have changed because the bridegroom is here with the guests. The rules were there to help you get right with God, but now I'm here and I'm bigger than the rules. I'm Lord over the rules. That's from that second passage, verse 5 of chapter 6. And then he says to the man with the withered hand, stretch out your hand. And of course, his hand is completely restored. He does the extraordinary miracle right in front of the Pharisees on the Sabbath. Does that make sense as we go back through the passages or this long passage? He's there, he's the bridegroom, he's with them. He's Lord over the Sabbath, he's bigger than the rules. And he calls them, he says, stretch out your hand, be restored. The rules were made for us, not us for the rules. And when Jesus comes, he brings new rules, and they're made for us too. And they're much easier and much more appealing. And all he asks is that we stretch out our hands. And yet, what is the Pharisees' reaction to that? Well, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were furious and began to discuss with one another what they might do to Jesus. So not only has he cast this vision of this great new way of being, not only has he said you don't have to do all these, like you don't have to live legalistically anymore, he's also proved his own divinity. And it should have been enough for them, but it isn't. And they only go back to prove that point from the first encounter. No one after drinking old wine wants the new, for they say the old is better. They can't get the taste of the old wine, of old religion, out of their mouths. And so they take this ridiculous decision that they'd rather do something to Jesus than accept he's right and they're wrong. And eventually that's what happens. The fault line develops into this chasm between them, and it ends with Jesus on the cross. So finally, in that context, it's time to ask one more time, where are we in that story? Are we with Jesus, who offers us this new rule book, which is about saying yes to him, relationship with him? Are we still with those Pharisees who are so tied to their traditions and their religious values, that the things that they were brought up with, the religion they were schooled in, that they can't see God standing right in front of them? Or are we maybe with that man with the shriveled hand who even though he shouldn't, even though he knows this is technically breaking the old law, dares to come to Jesus and ask him for restoration? I'd love to read you just this wonderful passage from the Message translation from Matthew 11. Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me. Get away with me and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me and you'll learn to live freely and lightly. That's the offer of Jesus. Back then, that's the offer of Jesus to each and every one of us this morning. Isn't it an incredible offer? Stretch out your hand.